she was doing something which is internationally significant and does deserve more appraisal.
A lot of her work seems to resonate in such a contemporary way.
She is her own woman.
I was quite ambitious to be a good sculptor. I went from having very good write-offs to very bad write-offs. And I felt very alienated by all that. And on the whole, I haven't had very happy experiences with critics for the last 2 decades.
Welcome to Sculpting Lives, a podcast with me, Sarah Turner.
And me, Jo Baring.
This episode is all about the sculptor Dame Elizabeth Frink, and I think I should probably just hand straight over to Jo right now, because Jo can talk about Liz Frink's work until the cows come home. Why? Tell us why you're so interested in Frink's work.
Well, I really like Frink. So Frink is born in 1930. She dies in 1993. Throughout her career, there's a real single-mindedness in terms of what she wants to do with the work. So she remains figurative at a time when there was a huge vogue for abstraction. She sticks resolutely to bronze when other people are investigating new materials. She sees early success in her career, the Tate by her work from her first solo show after graduation. But then it kind of tails off, and the art world, in inverted commas, quite sniffy about her. Even now, there's a kind of a sneeriness about the work of Elizabeth Frink, and I think she's been totally underrated. And Sarah, in this podcast, we're going to be reappraising her, aren't we?
Well, yeah, you're going to have to convince me a little bit. I think I've perhaps stereotyped her a little bit in the kind of category of, you know, dogs, horses. That's what I think of when I think of her work. But I'm sure there's a lot more to find out. And
there is.
One thing is, you know, just to have such a long and sustained career is something that I find really fascinating, and how an artist does that and actually retains popularity with the public as well.
Well, that's right. So she gets a huge amount of public commissions, and you know, you talk to people who aren't in the art world and they love the work of Elizabeth Frink. So there's a kind of a dichotomy there, isn't there, between how she's viewed by the art world and how she's viewed by the public. We went to see Simon Martin, who's the director of Pallant House Gallery in Chichester, to find out what he has to say about Frink's reputation and why he thinks it is as it is.
For me, Frink has always been an artist I've been aware of. I remember when I was doing art at school in the early 1990s, our art teacher made us watch a documentary about Frink installing the statue of Christ in Liverpool Cathedral, which must have been around the time she died, I think. And so it's amazing how moments like that can have a lasting awareness. And so for me, even since being a teenager, I've been very familiar with her work, and of course then seeing pieces in Salisbury and others, and of course, you know, following exhibitions and other galleries. But Frink, in terms of the wider art world, has never quite had the same reputation of some of her peers, which is sometimes, I think, a little bit baffling. And perhaps it's because so many of her works were all kept within the estate. But I think one of the things, of course, is actually as a figurative sculpture, there's sometimes an almost a kind of sniffiness about it. But actually, I think recent exhibitions, particularly, I think, there have been exhibitions, of course, at the Ginogli Art Gallery in Nottingham. I saw a few years ago there was the exhibition at Abbott Hall and Blackwell, and of course the Sainsbury Centre more recently. And each of those, I think, have actually helped place Frink in a different context and actually draw out different aspects of her work. And I think the exhibition at Hauser and Wirth, particularly with its focus on the kind of bird, man, bird figures in the 50s. Seeing that exhibition really kind of made me think of Frink in relation to artists such as Germaine Richier and Giacometti and others. And I think actually the moment you start to look at Frink in that context, you realise that she was doing something which was, you know, internationally significant and does deserve more appraisal. And I think also with Frink's work, because there are these distinctive bodies of work, and that there are lots of different possibilities as well.
Obviously, this is a podcast about gender, and Frink is kind of interesting in that during her lifetime, she totally shut down any conversations about gender, anyone who tried to ask her about the impact that it had or her private life had.
Why did she do that?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons which you can potentially think about. First of all, she's from quite a posh background, and I think there's still that kind of 20th century stiff upper lip, like, don't talk about personal things. She also is quoted as saying that the work speaks for itself. So she isn't the kind of person that will be writing artistic statements about what she wants people to read into the work.
We saw her biography as quite irrelevant to the work.
She totally did.
It somehow took away from the seriousness, which I can sympathise with that. And, you know, it is easy to get caught in these traps of trying to explain people's work away through
biography.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is someone who knows more about Frink than me, amazingly. And that is Annette Radtushniak, who is the curator of the Frink Estate. And actually, we asked her what she thought about Frink and gender.
From what we've deduced from the literature, she's very reticent to talk about that, and she shuts down all those conversations. Mm. Do you get that same sense?
Yes, I think I've come to a feeling that she doesn't want to be defined by that. She is her own woman, and she doesn't, you know, and what she's interested in is humanity. And these things that have her concerns, in a way, about who we are as human beings, what we do, not just to each other but to the whole planet, what it means to be human. And so if you're perhaps exploring that, then if you're perhaps defined by feminism, that feels slightly restricting, I suspect. And she had no problems with being a woman at all. You know, she is this very vibrant... People loved her, absolutely adored her. That was the first thing I discovered in the first 2 years of work, of actually how people just loved this woman. They loved being with her, and that wasn't because of her, you know, just for herself, as much as her work, the friends that she had. I think she could have found, she could have found it difficult to feel that she needed to be defined by anything. Whatever it was. But in a way, isn't that a great bit of feminism? In 1995, I was curator of Wiltshire Art Collections and based in Salisbury. And I used to walk past the Frink sculpture. I was really interested in it, partly because I thought it was a really interesting sculpture, and also because of how people reacted to it. And I just thought this little figure with the cathedral held that space so extraordinarily, so I wanted to find out more about her.
You're talking about the Walking Madonna sculpture.
The Walking Madonna, yes. And it was quite difficult to find out that much about Frink or to go and see more of her work. Actually, what I wanted to do was see more of her work. So I thought, well, I'll put on an exhibition. I discovered that Woolland and the studio and the house was still there, and that her son was living there. So I contacted Larne, and I went over to see him. And it was really quite astonishing, because there was so much presence of her. Although I'd never been to Woolland when she was there, just the place was just full of the presence of Liz Frink.
So was it like she just left the room?
Well, it's like as if she was still in the room, actually. Yes. So, and from what I gathered from... And then I started talking to people. But also, when I got to Woolland, Larne was obviously, you know, still reeling from his mother's death and trying to work out what on earth to do. Mm. You know, it's a big thing when you inherit your sort of mother's artistic estate as well as everything else. Liz's mother, Jean, was still alive, so I spent quite a lot of time chatting to Jean and Larne. And then basically what I had to do was if I was going to do an exhibition, I needed to sort out what was at Woolland.
Right.
So I went into the house, into the studio, and I just started going through all the material that was there, thinking, you know, finding the story that I wanted to tell.
Did you get a sense when you started working with the estate, when you stepped into Woolland, that Liz had been thinking during her lifetime of her legacy?
No.
Not at all?
Not really. I think she was so she was so focused. Well, there are several things, really. She was so focused on making the work. She had bought some pieces back. She did buy, as she, you know, later on, she did buy some examples of the work back, and she was having artist copies cast. So that she had her... because at Woolland, the whole point about being in Woolland was that... or the appeal of Woolland, I think, to her, was that it was this bigger environment which she could work with beyond the studio. So when you went to Woolland, you drove up these little lanes, mm-hmm. you turned through a very ordinary-looking sort of, you know, entrance, and there was a high bank on your left. And as you came round on your left, above that were the Dunstable flying figures. And then over to your left, over to your right, you just looked across Blackmore Vale. And then as you drove in to sort of park up in the sort of courtyard at Woolland, there were just sculptures everywhere. And you looked across and there were sculptures standing as she'd had it. There were, you know,
sculptures in the landscape.
Sculptures in the grounds, which she'd been playing sort of with that Lan hadn't, you know, sculptures sort of inside the courtyard before you went into the house, and in that way that was I came to associate with Woolland. So they were mixed up with, you know, garden tractors, children's toys, chickens, you know, the whole thing. It was just this amazing sort of environment. And when you went into the house, she was a great cook. She loved entertaining and cooking, although later on she had, particularly as she became sort of ill, she had someone to help with the cooking side. But, you know, she and Alex liked entertaining. So again, there was this wonderful mix. The house was full of her artworks that she had bought by other people or exchanged with friends. You know, so it was just this amazing environment to get a life-work balance with her husband and then child. She needed to be disciplined, because otherwise it's so easy for other things to sort of... sort of appear to be more important, so she did respect herself and to give herself that time to work on those things and think it was okay. That's sort of pretty obvious, and I think she got that quite early on, as you know, from when she was at art college. She took herself seriously, and she took the work seriously because of the nature of the work, in a way. She knew what it was that she wanted to explore. That was her way of dealing, living in the world, I think.
Is there anything in the archive, in letters or communication that you've come across that talks explicitly about that? So that idea that she had to carve out time for herself, that she had to perhaps separate family life from the work?
I think there aren't that many letters. I think it's the volume of material that shows that she... And talking to Lan knew his mum as this disciplined mum who would go into the studio. She'd go in early, sort of first thing in the morning she'd go in, and then she would work through to a sort of late lunchtime. Then it was domestic time. So and that was the routine, and she stuck to that routine. And obviously, you know, things change when you're doing exhibitions or you've got a commission you're doing sort of other things. But she was quite disciplined like that.
Frink has often been isolated, I think, from her social background. background and her context in which she grew up in which she was trained as an artist. So I think it's really important to put that back in the mix and see her as being formed by the changing circumstances of Britain in the war and post-war.
It's so true. So, you know, she's born in 1930. So when she's kind of 9 or 10, the Second World War breaks out. Her dad's in the army. So it's kind of must be, it's impossible to underestimate the impact that that would have on her.
Yeah, and those themes that she kind of pursues through her life of the birdman, of distorted human forms. Do you think that was shaped
by
war?
I think absolutely. So she always says that what she's really interested in is humanity and heroism, but also kind of vulnerability, about brutality, about what a human is able to do to one another. And those are the things that she's thinking about. I think that has to be formed in childhood, you know, with the impact of the war and all the kind of the, you know, the newsreels that she would have been seeing. She grew up near an army base as well, an air base. And she says that, you know, she saw planes falling from the sky, crashing, burning. She says that her and her friends used to go and inspect the wreckage the morning after, like little ghouls, she called them. You know, and I think that must have had a huge impact on her.
Yeah, and then she goes to London to train.
That's right.
And she is, again, part of a kind of post-war set in London of art students.
Yeah, I mean, she's in Soho in the 50s. Yeah. She's at Chelsea College of Art. You know, we all think of her as this kind of really posh, horsey kind of army woman. But actually, she's there in Chelsea with people like Francis Bacon, Lucian Freud, you know, the jazz singer George Melly. She's really at the heart of it, this kind of gathering of avant-garde, of modernism, of excitement, post-war excitement, isn't she?
Yeah, and I think putting her back within those contexts is really crucial to not isolate her anymore.
Yeah, and she also, at that time, she goes to Europe. So as a student, she went to Venice and she talks about the impact that that had on her, seeing things like the horses in St. Mark's Square. But in Paris, you know, she's kind of seeking out people like Giacometti as well. Another strand, which I think has been ignored from the kind of writing about her, about any interpretation of her, is an Irish connection. So her first husband, Michel Jamet, was a French-Irishman, and his parents ran this pretty cool restaurant, quite a famous restaurant called Jamet's in Dublin, which was the kind of centre for kind of Irish culture and literary meetings, gatherings, talkings. And it's something that we spoke to Annette about, and she was really interesting, actually, about the impact that that had on Frink's work too.
When she was married to Michel Jamet, he was French-Irish, and his family ran this amazing restaurant called Jamet's in Dublin. And that, and Liz started, when they sort of started being together and when they were married, she went there, they went there quite a lot because it was his sort of family home. But she, it meant that she was exposed to the sort of, because it was the place as well that writers and poets, people sort of with strong political thoughts, filmmakers gathered at Jamet's, and she was exposed to that, like at quite a young age. In a way, probably she wasn't exposed to it quite the same way in Chelsea. Although there would be some of that, but certainly in Dublin it would be big, and that affected her. And there is, from that period, there are these series of drawings which are about Cahoolan. I'm not quite sure if I pronounced that correctly, but anyway, that this sort of Irish, very important Irish mythological figure. And so the thing about Cahoolan is he destroys himself because he will not stop going to war. But what he does is, he realises it at the last minute when his horse, who has seen him through all these battles. So he's been to war, he's gone into battle on his horse, Learmarca. And then his friends and the people who love him try and stop him going to war. But they can't do it. And he goes back to war. And what happens is that Learmarca dies, is killed. And at that point, he realises what he's done. But it's too late. So she does these series of drawings and other things around that. It's the only myth that she actually sort of describes and writes and uses that, you know, those words. So you've got Cahoolan with the tears coming out of his eyes. You've got him, and you've got the horse as well. And then later on, when she's at Woolen, she does a whole series of wounded horses. And there's a real resonance between that, and you can see that continuum of thought and how she's now expressing it.
Frink's commitment to bronze has perhaps made her seem, you know, quite a traditional sculptor in many ways, because it's such a historic material. You know, it makes you think about classical antiquity. But in so many ways, she really experimented with that medium and with those materials.
It's so true. So if you think about how she actually created those bronze sculptures, she's looking to Europe. So when she first comes out of art school, you know, who she's being taught by, who are the kind of the godfather of British sculpture at the time, or someone like Henry Moore. So he is using very traditional techniques to make those bronze sculptures, in that he's using clay to mould them. And actually, Frink finds clay really heavy and quite hard going, and it doesn't give her that immediacy that she wants. You know, she wants a real connection to the material. So as I said, she looks to Europe, to people like Giacometti and Germaine Richier, and what they're doing is they're building up the models in plaster. So Frink, she kind of builds up the armature, so she gets things, it's basic things, like even like chicken wire, mm-hmm. puts it on, and then she can get this wet plaster, and she gets her hands dirty, and she's just moulding, moving, and it dries so quickly that she just has to kind of create it. There's such an immediacy there, isn't there?
You can see all those drips and pores. I mean, I was thinking it's almost like action painting, but in sculpture.
Exactly, it's so true. And then once it's dried, she then carves back, she puts more in. And I think if you get a chance to get up close and personal with a Frink sculpture, you actually see her fingerprints in the finished bronze.
So that immediacy.
Absolutely. So there's a real physicality. And that's why she didn't use assistants, which is something that's really important to point out. She, you know, maybe later on she might have needed some assistants when she was doing kind of larger pieces to help with the armature. But when it came to putting the plaster on, that was all her.
And there's another area of her work which perhaps hasn't been explored in depth, and that is her intersection with kind of contemporary events and the political context of her time. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, she, I suppose maybe it was a kind of a thing, a 20th century artistic thing, that she felt that she had, as an artist, she felt she had a moral obligation to draw people's attention to what was going on in the world. So not only, as we talked about earlier, the kind of, you know, the brutality of humanity in terms of the Second World War, but things like, you know, she was reading about the Algerian wars and things like that, and she was making work in response to those. So contemporary events, she made works about martyrs, and she was really...
About the Troubles in Ireland.
Exactly, exactly. And that was something that she was quite overt about being influenced by.
Do you feel that she had a political responsibility? She's obviously a member of various, you know, political groupings.
Yes. Well, she shows that through, again, through her deeds. So she supports Amnesty International. She creates quite a lot of work that she gives to various charities. She creates work for, you know, for fundraising for charities. I don't... You know, she sits on the board of the British Museum. The volumes that we have from terms of charities, you know, fill a few boxes. They filled a filing cabinet. So she did have a strong moral sense, I think, yes, in that way, in terms of our responsibility as a human being. And again, that doesn't matter whether you're male or female, does it? And she's her friends... So she has friends, a lot of friends, who are also telling those sort of stories as writers. So Michael Morpurgo, Brian Phelan, people like that. Got to remember that with the Royal Academy, she is the first woman to be appointed, you know, to be taken into that fold for sculpture.
Absolutely.
So, but I think that's probably respect from other artists. Mm.
And I think perhaps her links with an earlier generation, like you mentioned, yes. Sukop and people like that, who had an important... Those emigre sculptors who had... the RA was a home for them.
Yes.
And I think they were probably very supportive of her work and the kind of work. Mm. But again...
And they probably got it.
Yeah.
They got the radicalism of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that idea of him commenting on... You know, difficult subjects about humanity. Again, that was what they were interested in.
Yes.
And thinking, well, what's the future of sculpture? Mm. What's the future of sculpture in the Royal Academy? And by all accounts, it sounds like she was sort of tipped to be perhaps the first female president, although that didn't happen.
No, and I can't remember whether, because I still haven't gone through in depth all the archive. So there will be maybe things about that, but my impression is... from somewhere, but also she didn't want to do that because she wanted to concentrate on work.
Frink was tirelessly committed to depicting the human and the animal body. But Jo, do you think that commitment to figuration has somehow hampered her reputation or the critical assessment of her work in some way?
I think that we can't interpret Frink without looking at the wider context of what was going on. So if we think about the 1950s when she's coming out of art school, that was a time when there was a really influential art critic called Herbert Reed, and he coined this phrase about a group of basically predominantly, well, all white male sculptors called the Geometry of Fear. And they were kind of dominating British art at that time. And actually, they were kind of beating Giacometti to the Sculpture Prize at the Venice Biennale. So kind of internationally significant. But really what they were doing was it was very much a response to the Second World War. And it was figurative, but it was kind of spiky and difficult and tricky and was kind of very still traumatised by those experiences. Frink was a generation younger and didn't quite fit into that. But then in the 60s, the bright, shiny 60s comes along with a whole, well, what's called the new generation of sculptors. So people like Anthony Caro, Philip King. And, you know, these guys are kind of painting steel and putting it on the floor.
So, and working in an abstract way.
Completely. So it's abstract, it's bright. And you can see why the old Geometry of Fear sculptors almost just got pushed aside straight away. You know, no one wanted to look backwards anymore.
Well, it seems of another time, doesn't it? It's very much conditioned by the experiences of war, and abstraction is showing a kind of way forward, like you say, a bright new future.
Exactly. And Frink doesn't fit into that either.
So she's kind of caught in the middle.
She's caught in the middle. And you know, we all love to pigeonhole people. We love to put people in their boxes. And I think the problem with Frink is that she doesn't fit in anywhere.
And she doesn't want to fit.
She doesn't want to fit. Absolutely. So she goes to France to get away from it, from what she calls the dogma of abstraction.
Right.
But what I think is really interesting is that it's getting a kind of a contemporary sculptor's input on Frink, and that kind of, you know, the kind of the obviously the sort of the difficulty that she had kind of juggling figuration, abstraction. What do you do as a sculptor? Do you move towards abstraction or not?
Yeah, so we went with Kathy Pilkington, who is another Royal Academician. And with Kathy, we stood by one of Frink's sculptures outside on a very, very busy street in London, as all the motorcycles and builders and all the kind of hubbub of London life is happening around us. And we just really look carefully at the surfaces of Frink's Horse and Rider together, and just talked about those kind of material processes and how Kathy interprets Frink's work.
So it seemed like the work was at this really crucial moment when she moved off to France and started to make her Goggleheads. She was moving away from what was happening at Central St Martin's with Caro and the anti-figuration.
Yeah, what she called the dogma of abstraction, didn't she?
Yeah. And of course, you know, figuration can always be relevant, but it's what you do with it. And I think what she started to do with the Goggleheads was really exciting. It was almost like she was moving towards pop art. But the way she talked about them was still in this, like, she's talking about them in terms of heroicism and the past. And actually, I'm looking at them thinking, is he a menacing character or is he a dude by the pool with his shades? And so if you look at those in a contemporary way, what was really fascinating about them was that there was this self-contained object with shiny shades on. So the shades are really, it's from a really contemporary
photograph. It's from a newspaper. What,
yeah, it was from a photograph. But as an object in itself, regardless of where it came from, it's bringing in things from the contemporary world, from now, and putting them on a classical bust. And the viewer is then reflected in those as well. So she's starting to have a contemporary discussion about the object and the subject and the viewer and the context and the history. And also allowing things like cartoon imagery and pop culture to come in, which I think is absolutely crucial if she was going to take that figuration forward. And my feeling is that then she retreats back to the safety of a classical kind of statuary, and makes
which is what
this
we're looking
work,
at now. So a male figure on a horse.
So she actually starts to engage with the problems of it in a critical and contemporary way, and then she retreats back to this kind of safety of something that actually is problematic to me. And I think at the end of the biography, there's a sentence that says the English embraced her sculpture. There was nothing to be frightened at. There was nothing to fear, nothing to question. They embraced it happily.
in the 1960s, Frink moves to France, possibly to get away from what's going on in London and also the wider art world, and just to give herself some time and some space to make new work. And actually, we asked Annette Ratushniak about the impact that that move to France had on the work that she's producing.
So when she gets to France, the light is different, and she talks about that. And, of course, she's got more space. She's not in this closed-in, well, you know, these smaller studios. She's a big open sort of space, a huge amount of light, and so therefore a huge amount of glare. You can't see surfaces with the glare, or else you would just get this horrible sort of light, dark jaggedness coming back to you. So that's when she starts to smooth off the surfaces. So therefore to smooth them off and to apply more, more subtle lines and create very subtle surfaces on these bigger volumes. Because also I think when you go up in volume, if you've got a very jaggedy surface, you've got too much to read. Mm-hmm. If you can sort of take that down, so you've got some rhythm. So it's in, you know, you've got very active surfaces, you've got very calm surfaces. The active, you know, there's this wonderful balance between them. So that means she has to take the plaster slightly drier to get that. She was in a place where there was, a lot of raw energy from animals and birds, and thinking, you know, and she does her first horse and rider, well, not her first, because there's a very early horse and rider from student days, but we've only got evidence of that in photographs. Mm-hmm. But she does her absolutely fabulous horse and rider, and she's riding herself. So I think all those things are sort of going on and really important. And when she's confident enough, I know another marriage breakdown, if she's confident enough, she comes back to Britain. But then she moves to Dorset. She doesn't stay in London.
What Frink is probably best known for now in terms of her legacy are the public commissions that we can see on our streets, towns and our churches. Don't you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I think she's very committed to making sculpture for public life and putting works in places that, you know, ordinary people could encounter it. So you can find her work in Harlow, in Belfast, also abroad. I think she had a really major gig in the US.
Yeah, that's so true. So she actually got the JFK Memorial. She did the JFK Memorial for Dallas, which is incredibly impressive.
And another area of sculptural display that really interested her was the idea of creating a sculpture park where your major works could be displayed outdoors.
Yeah, she was really interested in the idea of sculpture in landscape. And so we went up to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, one of your favourite places, to go and talk to the director of programming there, Claire Lilly, about what she had to say about the importance of Frink.
Elizabeth Frink is a really important, another really important artist here. Mm. Because Elizabeth Frink was really keen that there was a sculpture park in England or in Britain. And she was, in the early 80s, involved in a move in South Wales to establish a sculpture park there, which sort of didn't quite happen. But Peter Murray met her, and she came here. And so she was a really amazing champion of the sculpture park. And he did a show with her in, I think, 83. And as a result of that, she gifted some work. And so we've always had a presence of Frink here.
Such a productive and busy career obviously builds up such a body of work. And at her final home and studio, Woolland in Dorset, Frink built up this incredible collection, not only of her own work, but the work of other artists that she was interested in. She was also collecting works from Africa, from Oceania as well. And this kind of built up an incredible legacy, which when she died was left behind. And Joe, I know it's something that you've been thinking about particularly, is the issue of artists' estates and how they build reputations.
I'm so interested actually in the impact that artist families have on artistic legacy and reputation. So if you think about it, Frink dies in 93. She has one son, Lan Jamet, from her first marriage. And he inherits everything. So you've got this huge house, Woolland. It's stuffed to the gills with everything. There's sculpture in the landscape. There's two different studios, I think. You know, there's two kind of granny flats where there's so much to kind of to go through. And also, people are dealing with the death of a parent. So there's huge emotional turmoil and also a kind of a responsibility. And you know, what do they do? Who do they go to? And I think quite a lot of it was simply left. And actually, that's where Annette came in. So Annette, over the last, I don't know, 20, 25 years, has actually been going through that huge archive and what's been left at Woolland. Very sadly, Lan died quite suddenly. And in the few months that he was able to make decisions about what he wanted to do with his mother's estate, he had a number of conversations with Annette. And the decision was made to gift the Frink estate to the nation, which is an incredibly generous gift. And also, you know, they had to think very carefully about which institutions works should go to, and the archive. We went down, so the archive actually went to the Dorset History Centre, because of those links with Dorset, and we went down to speak to the director there, Sam Johnston, about the impact that having such an incredible archive will have on what he's able to offer. And then we also asked Annette about the hopes that Lan had for Frink's estate.
It's a hugely important collection for us to have here. It raises our profile in all kinds of ways. It makes us, we're aware of connections we have with institutions, certainly within the UK, but beyond. And through Annette, largely, I've become, you know, much more aware of what we might be able to do with this collection. So it's been a long process of slowly acquiring it here. It's come in a number of, quite a few different separate accessions. Photographic material came in first, but then as Annette and worked her way through the Frink legacy, really, the you know, the estate and its holdings, more and more material came to light. So works of art on paper, all the material that you'll eventually come to see as it's catalogued.
I sat with Lan, and he was able to express, because he was in a very bad way, that he wanted that material to go to the nation. So he and I were able to just about talk through, you know, how to do that. So we came up with a context where the because you're talking thousands of things. Mm-hmm. We'd already started, one of the helpful things was we'd already started to move some of the papers and photographs into the History Centre as part of the National Archives. So here in Dorchester, because they needed better environmental conditions than you can store bronzes and drawings, and particularly the photographs. So we were able to build on that with the idea that there would be a spread of her work across England, Scotland and Northern Ireland.
But what a hugely generous gift.
Oh, it's fantastic. And I think it is the best thing. It's so sad that Lan's died, but it's the best thing for Frink. Because now there are these strong collections of work, really a vast, you know, vast amount of work by her can be seen by the public alongside all the work that they love and know on the streets. Mm-hmm. And it's a fantastic opportunity also for the thing that was missing from her work, which are the academic studies, the opportunity for PhD students, for undergraduates, for people who are writing books, you know, for anybody who's sort of looking at that, to actually really get up close to her work and to see it.
Jo, you've been working on Liz Frink for quite a while. In your capacity as director of the Ingram Collection, you hold quite a number of her
works. Yeah, we've got 28 works by Frink in the collection, and we've lent them to, you know, a huge number of exhibitions over the years. And I've definitely seen a sea change in the way that people are presenting Frink.
So you know those works really well, but you obviously still feel that there's more to find out.
I definitely do. I mean, you know, and even kind of talking to you, you know, I think that she's sometimes seen as, you know, someone who doesn't fit in to the kind of the narrative, the traditional narrative of British art. But actually, if you see her in the context of European modernism, that's when she really begins to make sense, doesn't she?
Definitely. I think doing this episode has helped me see her in a much more expanded field of sculptural practice. And that has been, you know, really enriching.
Join us next time, where we'll be looking at the work of the sculptor Kim Lim.
We'd like to thank everyone who has helped us with this episode, to our interviewees, and particularly to the Artist Lives project at the British Library, which allowed us to use the recordings of Liz Frink.
We'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Paul Mellon Centre for Studies in British Art. And all the works by Frink that we talk about in this episode are available to view on our Instagram page, which is @sculptinglives. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
This podcast was written and presented by Sarah Victoria Turner and Joe Baring, produced by Claire Lynch, with research assistance from Isabel Mooney.